from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Click on the subscribe button and telling about our show to a friend, family member, or a coworker. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen, and joining me, he got snubbed again for the Nobel Prize in Economics, Yochai Elam. How's it going, Yochai?
Hi, Lior. I'm doing great. Don't worry, I'll win next year.
You got my voice, man, that's for sure.
Yeah, okay, that's already one voice, yeah.
In the meantime, this week we'll talk about the British economy, the falling oil prices, and the global gloom. Is the situation so dire? But first, here are several questions investors and traders should ask themselves that could improve their strategies. So, Yochai, go bring us through it. What are some of the questions we should ask ourselves?
Yeah, so last time we talked about these questions, we had a handful, and now we'll talk about a few more. The next one we have is, how do you deal with unexpected events? Because markets, as we know, and especially today, are a bit crazy. We do have to take into account, put in the back of our head, do something about those long tail and black swan events that happen, and you should probably have a plan for action for when they hit. Even if this plan is way back in the drawer, it should be there, it should exist.
When you talk about black swans, obviously we immediately think about Nassim Taleb and his, obviously the title of his book, The Black Swan. I won't go on too much of a tangent, but I will say that this guy is obviously a marketing genius when it comes to repurposing the analogy of the black swan that was taken, he took, and you know, give credit to Karl Popper. But you're right, when it comes to especially in the financial markets and in this day and age, we see that there is a lot of volatility sometimes, and it could come out of the blue. I mean, talk about oil prices. Yesterday, on Tuesday, they fell by 4.5% in a single day. Now, these kind of events, if we talk about how the distribution of the financial markets should come, many assume that it's resemble a normal distribution, in which there are very thin tails at the edges, and there's very low probability of a sudden sharp turn of more than 3 or 4 standard deviations. It's very unlikely.
Yeah, very unlikely, but once it happens, it's big.
Well, but that's the thing. It's more likely than we were to assume, and that's what we Nassim Taleb says, and a lot of also other economists, mathematicians have been telling us for the past several decades, that when you look at the financial markets, and let's even take what happened on Tuesday. The oil prices fell by 4.5% in a single day. And if you look at the standard deviation of oil prices, the daily, which is the standard deviation of the daily percent changes, you look at it over the past couple of years, it was around 1%. So a deviation of 4.5% in a single day is equivalent of four and a half times of the standard deviation of the oil prices. And this kind of a occurrence under the normal distribution should only happen once every 147,160 days.
Wow.
So this is equivalent of only once every 403 years.
Well, it happens every 4 years, not every 400 years, yeah.
So it happens much more frequent than when we assume a normal distribution. Actually, it happens much more frequent than that. It happens in what we can implement it as to much more of a fat tail distribution, where there are much fatter tails at the edges. Unlikely events happen much more frequent than what we give credit for in the under the normal distribution scheme. So, as you said, this is something that when we look at black swan events and long tail, we should know that it happened much more frequent that we give credit for when we take into account that we look at a normal distribution and use it to make some other investment decisions, such as taking into account the correlations and regressions and all those fancy words. These kind of tools are taking into account that there is a normal distribution, even though they're in most cases, there isn't. When you talk about that, that's something that's very, very important to notice and to take into account that, as you said, the black swan events could happen much more frequent than we give credit for.
Right. And I think that after a very long period of low volatility and the lack of these black swan or even white swan events of or any events whatsoever, now we did enter, since the end of August, beginning of September, a period of high volatility and a higher chance of black swan, purple swan events.
Maybe even a blonde.
A blonde swan. Yeah, we can't rule out anything in these markets. So
yeah, there we go.
With this flash crash that we've seen just now. So anything can happen, and you have to be prepared if you want to trade these markets and survive. Because these kind of events, if you're highly leveraged, if you're not prepared for them, they can just wipe out your account in seconds. And if you have a move of 100 pips and you're looking for a gain or a loss of 10, 20, 30 pips, well, if it goes in your direction, it's nice. But even if it goes in your direction and you're not prepared to take profit, these moves can be erased quite quickly, as we've seen this week, so be prepared.
So that's good that when we take into this account that there is a very high, there is a chance of a black swan event that could happen quite imminent. We have to also, as you said, when it talks to be prepared when it comes to the leverage that we take, when it comes to the volatility of a certain asset, we have to look back to see how volatile it is and see, okay, if it's that volatile, maybe we have to be a little bit more conservative when it comes to this asset. There is a chance of a sudden flash, a crash, or sudden jump if we're going short on a certain asset. Okay, so what else?
So if we're talking about risks and high volatility and extreme moves, one way to battle it, to be prepared, is to diversify. Diversification can be a very effective way of reducing risk without destroying overall returns, so you should at least investigate it. That means you should try to trade more than one currency pair. That doesn't mean trading all the euro-dollar, pound dollar, Aussie dollar, New Zealand dollar, but if you're trading euro dollar, perhaps you could trade pound yen, you could trade across another currency pair that doesn't involve the same currencies. That's the diversification. Don't be closed and focused just on one market. And if you're also into stocks, commodities, bonds, whatever, go for it. You should at least take a look at other markets and see how you can find other opportunities and how you can diversify your portfolio. As we know, putting all the eggs in one basket can crash the basket, and we don't want that.
Oh man, I happen that every time that I go to the supermarket. So yeah, I'm forbidden of buying eggs anymore. So yeah, that's not my chore. But yeah, I totally agree with that. And when you look at diversification, also one way of looking at it is also to take into account the correlations between those several assets and to see if there is a low correlation. Of course, to take in with an asterisk of what we talked about earlier, about they have some limitations when it comes to a normal distribution, that correlations are under the assumption that there are normal distributions. But still, one way to look at it is to see the correlations between two assets or between currency pairs, see that it's very low. I remember, for instance, that a friend of mine made an investment for one of his firms, and he took in South Korean won and GE bonds. And one of the reasons, because they have very low correlation between these two events, so between these two assets. So even though there is a little bit of correlation, because if the US economy will suddenly tank, as it did back in 2008, the won will most likely also have a reaction, but it will have a little bit less of a reaction compared to other economies that are much closer to the US and are much more impacted by such a turn of events. So yeah, okay, so that there's that.
Yeah, let's finish off with one more thing about trying to find out what the strength and the weaknesses of your strategy are, because no strategy is perfect. I mean, if you had a perfect strategy, you wouldn't be listening to our show, I would assume. but if it was, yeah, if it would be able to make unlimited returns, this never happens. Your strategy is never perfect, nor is anybody's. So try to understand the strategy better so you can improve it over time. Improving it can be using diversification, which we talked about beforehand. It can be by doing some small tweaks, trying to set thinner, tighter stop losses, wider ones. The idea is not to play with it all the time. First and most important thing is to be aware of the strengths and weaknesses, and when to use it, your strategy with higher leverage with a bigger amount, and when to limit it when it's in a weak position, and when to invest less because you're less certain of the situation when the strategy is in its weakness point. So being aware can certainly improve your trading, your profitability, your happiness in general.
All right, that's cool. And from trading, let's go to the UK, and we have a lot of commotion over there also. And so what's happening now with the UK and the British pound?
Well, in the past year or so, everything seemed very rosy, and this rosiness continues. continued until actually the second quarter of 2014, which is just a few months ago. So growth was upgraded in the final rate to 0.9% quarter over quarter. That's around 3.6% annually. We did see strong growth according to the soft data to the purchasing managers' indices, PMIs, in all figures, but recently they did begin to diverge. So we still see extreme growth in construction, and this is also seen in the skyline of London where you see lots of cranes. But the biggest sector, services, is just okay, and the PMI for manufacturing is hardly growing. It continues to fall. Manufacturing is currently the weakest link in the UK economy.
Goodbye.
Another thing, one of the things that have worsened is the situation in the Eurozone, which of course everybody knows about it, and the UK is not that far from the Eurozone. So the British politicians are blaming the Eurozone. Of course, they want to do it because there's a referendum in potential in 2017 about the UK leaving the European Union, but it's also, the blame is real. The UK needs Europe for growth, so that's one of the reasons. We're seeing the one of the European diseases, the low inflation or fear of deflation, already creeping in to the UK with a five-year low of 1.2% in the recent data.
Yeah, and that's very low. And what's and on the one hand, we have very low inflation, and it's going on in Europe, as you said, and now in Britain as well. And the British pound is strengthening against the euro, obviously, with the ECB lowering its rates and plans to implement additional monetary charges in order to reduce even further the euro against other leading currencies. And what do we see from the MPC? We see that they are maybe contemplating raising rates. So is that such a good move of doing so?
Well, so inflation is really low. It's around the lower bound. The bound that the MPC, the Bank of England, has is 1.2, is between 1 and 3%. So 1.2 is already close to the lower bound, in which the governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, would have to write a letter to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, explaining why they missed the target. And that's the only mandate BOE actually has. But if you look a little bit deeper into the data, we see that the UK economy is doing a bit better. The retail price index is still at a healthy 2.3%. That's just around the 2% perfect target and just above. So most of the fall is more in energy prices. We'll talk about that, of course, as well. And that isn't that bad. So how can we see that the UK economy is doing well? Well, the unemployment continues falling. It reached 6% in August. That's really good data. That means that the improvement continued into the third quarter as well. Wages are still growing a bit slow, just 0.7% in August. But I think that wages will eventually rise, and also the Bank of England, some people there don't seem that worried about that. It's important to remember that 2 out of 9 members voted for a rate hike in the past 2 meetings. What we can worry about is the jobless claims. They fell at a clip of about 30,000 unemployed every month, and in September, the most recent data, they fell only by 18,600. That's less than expectations, and that could be a bit worrying, but it could also be a one-off. All in all, I do see the UK economy is still doing well, but recently some dark clouds over all the global economy, and specifically the Eurozone, are weighing also on the British pound. We're seeing what you talked about, the trend of euro pound falling. We're seeing that stabilize because the UK economy is falling together with the European economies.
So what are the current expectations when it comes to the rate hike? When the current markets see the next rate hike to occur?
I think expectations still stand in the second quarter of 2015. Some expected it to be as soon as November. I think there's almost no chance of that happening. February then seemed to be the best date, but now some market participants are pricing it only in August 2015, which is far off. I think that we're currently in this kind of market storm and gloom, and eventually spring of 2015, means around March, could see a rate hike. After, we're going to see rises also in wages and some kind of stabilization, hopefully also in the Eurozone. So we'll know a bit more on October 22nd when we'll see the MPC meeting minutes. Also here, expectations are split between those that think that the two dissenters will come back to line with the governor, that will have a unanimous vote 9-0 against the change in hikes. there still is an outside chance that we'll have an additional member voting for a rate hike. I believe that we'll stay in the middle. In any case, the lack of consensus, this uncertainty will surely cause extreme volatility on October 22nd when the MPC meeting minutes are released.
All right, so we have that to look forward to and see what's next for the MPC and the British pound. You talked a little bit about oil, so let's turn to oil prices and what's going on? I mean, we just woke up in October and suddenly we saw over a 10% drop in oil prices, and the oil prices are now at around $82, the lowest they've been in the past year, lowest they've been in the past several years. And everybody are saying, yeah, we'll see it at $80 and for a while. So what is going on? When we look about the fundamentals, we have to look about the supply, the demand, the inventories. We see that there is some much more looser oil markets at hand. And this, along with some other recent, you know, speculations, reports about where OPEC is targeting its production, I think that these two, turn of events are keeping oil prices now at such a low price. So what happened? From the one hand, we see that OPEC continues to slowly progress with its production. In the last month, it came to 30.5 million barrels, which is a little bit over 1% gain compared to August. And most of the gain came from Libya and Iraq. Libya reached almost 800,000 barrels per day, and that's the highest level it's been in the past several years, even though it's still far off from the 1.6 million barrels per day it used to produce back in 2010. It's still a very hefty recovery for Libya's oil output. So this is one thing to consider. And the rising oil production in Libya is also closing the gap, is helping to close the gap between Brent and WTI. There are, of course, other factors to consider from the US, but I talked about it last time. Let's focus about the more global trends. So we have that, and we have also Saudi Arabia is also in the news, and suddenly we see that they're saying, yeah, we're okay with oil prices remaining at the current levels of below 90 or even the low 80s for the next couple of years. That's not going well with other OPEC members, of course. Iran, Venezuela are obviously pushing to cut oil quota in order to bring back oil prices to the $100 mark. Russia isn't too happy with that also. They need the oil prices to be much higher to cover their productions. And
they have some military expenses as well, so they would need the extra oil money, yeah.
So we have that. Also, there's oil production going up also in non-OPEC countries. In the last report by the IEA, the International Energy Agency, they showed that the non-OPEC countries also raised their production. So last month, OPEC and non-OPEC countries combined output grew by 910,000 barrels per day to 93.8 million barrels per day. So that's pretty hefty and more than in line with the current demand.
So that's shale oil from the United States or other resources as well?
Yeah, it's obviously we have a continuous growth in the US, but also other countries continued also to slowly increase their output. But yeah, mostly it's from the US. When we look also at the production, we can also look at that it also comes into account that the inventories are also building up, and the OECD commercial oil inventories, according to the IEA, also build up to 37.7 million over August, and that's also narrowing the gap from the 5-year average deficit of 38.1 million. These data also show that as inventories build up, it also loosened the oil market and shows a little bit less strength on the oil prices to come back up. So this is another issue to consider. So we have OPEC keeping its production pretty high, and Libya and Iraq building up, recovering with a higher production. Saudi Arabia is comfortable with oil prices remaining low, and we have non-OPEC countries also raising their production. That's from the supply side. Yeah. Let's go to the demand side. And from the demand side, we had the IMF come up with its global economic outlook, and it lowered it for 2014 and 2015.
Yeah, again, it's certainly not the first time. Yeah,
yeah, they reduced it again over concerns from growth in China, Brazil, Russia, and of course the EU. For 2013, they revised it down from 3.7 to 3.3%, and for 2015, from 3.9 to 3.8%. Following this outlook, of course, the IEA slashed its outlook for the global demand for oil. And for 2014, they revised it down by 0.2 million barrels per day, so to 92.4. And the demand is expected to grow by only 0.7 million in this year and 1.1 million next year. So these projections suggest that we'll see a lower consumption of oil this year and also next year. When you take into account that on one hand we see lower demand or a slower growth in demand for oil, and on the other hand we see a rising supply from OPEC and non-OPEC countries, so these two combined give us low prices at $80, at least for now. If suddenly we'll see a shift in Saudi Arabia saying, yeah, you know what, we said $80, we change our mind, or maybe if we'll see more restrictions and more fraction, more problems between among OPEC members, and maybe they'll come up with a different quota and reduce it again in the OPEC meeting in December, there could be some adverse impact on the oil market.
Yeah, because, well, if the price of oil falls a lot, then there is less motivation for more shale projects as well in the United States, and that could eventually lower the supply and raise oil prices back. So the Saudis, I guess, want a weaker price of oil, but not extremely weak. Eventually, it'll also hit them with their budget, right?
Yes, of course. If it'll go below $80, that's not something that they'll be happy about. So I think they'll be very happy with 80 and above. But that's it. If it goes below 80, they'll not be too happy about that as well. And I recall that.
So that's critical support.
Yes, and I recall that even back in 2010, when oil prices were around $80, I remember I even wrote an article about it. Back then, even I remember Saudi Arabia. They talked about $80. It's a good target for them. They're comfortable with it for the next couple of years. And after that, in 2011, we had all the commotion over Libya and oil prices jumped to $100. Yeah, even before that, so they were pretty consistent back then, and at least now they're falling back in line to the $80 mark, and we'll see what's going on. But for now, it seems that oil prices will remain around the low 80s, especially when we see the US dollar also making such shifts and turns, and crashing after its rally in the previous several weeks.
Yeah, so it's also an issue of demand.
Yeah, so we have that to consider as well. And we talked about demand, so let's talk about the global economy. What's going on? Are we in such a dire situation? Is the U.S. economy, the German, the Chinese economies, are they doing so poorly? So let's kick it off with the U.S.
Yeah, well, the U.S. is not doing poorly at all. I mean, we've seen poor data from retail sales, and we are seeing in general, some weak data here and there. But the bigger picture is that employment continues to improve. We're seeing that in non-farm payrolls, in JOLTS, in jobless claims. We're seeing it in purchasing managers' indices, which look forward. We see that in many other figures. And the most important one is, of course, jobs, which is part of the Fed's mandate. But this triggers the end of quantitative easing this month. And when there's no more fast printing of U.S. dollars, there's less money to move around and to push stocks, commodities, and everything else higher. So this is one of the issues causing trouble. Now, even though the FOMC minutes, it could be understood as pushing back rate hike expectations, this is a result of a weaker U.S. economy or a weaker global economy, and that is part of the global gloom. So as you've said around oil prices, weak demand and the high supply, it seems like a perfect storm. Also in the global economy, it seems like a perfect storm now of gloom, which is a bit exaggerated in my opinion. The biggest problem is the Eurozone. Germany led forward the Eurozone, it was the locomotive, while the others were behind, and now Germany is in trouble. The economy contracted in the second quarter, and the third quarter doesn't look good. We had poor factory orders, poor industrial output in August, and now negative business confidence in September, which means pessimism among German industrials. And then we had the downwards revision of the forecast for growth and for inflation by the German government. But hand in hand with this, they're refusing to change the austerity stance. They're not moving, even though they're being called for by Draghi, by the ECB. And they are in a discord with France, the same as Saudi Arabia is with its OPEC members. So France doesn't want to make budget cuts, join German austerity, and Germany sticks to its stance. So all this discord also in the Eurozone is also weighing, and it seems that the ECB cannot do much more.
So the Germans and the French are at it again? So this is like the never-ending story with these two countries, is it?
Well, they used to be the countries that took the Eurozone forward, that the whole European project forward, and in the time of Nicolas Sarkozy, he had a very cozy relationship with Angela Merkel. Hollande, the current president, which is in control for over 2 years, promised to do the opposite. Only now he's a bit getting to it, but the situation in France is worsening, the economy is stagnating. So, but the bigger worries are about the bigger country, about Germany. If Germany is contracting, who can pull the Eurozone forward? And this, of course, has an impact on the UK, as we mentioned before, has an impact on oil prices, has an impact on other countries as well. We talked about the US, we talked about Germany, China. China is letting its economy cool down. This is very, very gradual. It's the soft landing, it's engineered, and they're not doing any serious new stimulus. So they're cutting here and there some kind of reserve ratio rates, they're helping this, they're helping that, but in general, they're allowing the economy to cool down. At the same time as the Fed is doing its end of quantitative easing and eventually a rate hike. We'll get the Chinese GDP very soon, actually, on October 21st. Last time it was the perfect 7.5% that the Communist Party was aiming for. This time it'll be a bit lower. These numbers are not to be believed, but they still move the markets quite a bit. So we have, all in all, three big powers. The United States going towards tightening, Germany slowing down, and the ECB that can't do all on its own. And China, the world's number two economy, actually allowing its economy to slow down. So if these three powers are going in this kind of direction, that's why we see lower forecasts for oil and sell-off in stock markets and a rush for yield, especially as there's danger of deflation basically everywhere, but especially in the Eurozone. So there's a rush for yield and bonds are going up.
Yeah, the demand for bonds staggering now. Huh? Everybody are starting to jump ship from equities and going back treasury bonds.
Right. So we've seen U.S. Treasury bonds dip below 2%. German 10-year bonds are well below 1%. They're just above 0.80. We've seen U.K. bonds drop, Basically, 2-year yields are near zero in some countries or below zero in Germany, Switzerland, Netherlands. This reflects slow growth. This reflects a fear of deflation. And this is also a result of the sell-off in the stock markets. As aforementioned, if there is no cheap money to run around, the ECB is not moving that fast to take the baton from the Fed, then there's no money to pump up stocks. And if there's no artificial thing to pump up stocks, we also don't have a real reason to buy stocks because valuations, according to some, are frothy, stretched, exaggerated. And this comes from the IMF and the Federal Reserve back in July. So these are not just the hedge funds looking too short, but the big bodies worried about stretched valuations. So decline in the global economy, no more big QE programs, and stock market that seems high and is looking for a correction for a long time. All this is also the perfect storm for stocks.
Wow, so between perfect storm and frothy weather, we're heading for some cloudy and with a chance of meatballs. So yeah, we have all that combined, all the movies combined. Yeah. So that'll be interesting to see how that will entail, and we'll have to come up with additional metaphors.
Of course, winter is coming. Brace yourselves.
Yeah, brace yourselves. Well, not here. We're in Argentina. It's summer, so yeah, I'm okay.
All right. Yeah, stay there.
So, okay, that's it. Thank you, as usual, Yochai.
Thank you, Lior.
So, until next time, this is Lior signing off for Yochai, saying have a great week and invest responsibly.
For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com. where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make Market Movers possible.